Well, as an old apostle, Simon Peter is writing a letter to believers. They're under pressure to back away from their association with Christ. Their testimony has already sort of messed up their lives, turned everything upside down. They've been dispersed. They've lost their property, their homes, their friends, their jobs. When Peter writes to them, they're scattered in places like Galatia and Pontus and Bithynia and Asia, modern-day Turkey. The pressure is only continuing to grow. So in writing to them, to encourage them, he says this in the third chapter of his first letter. Whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking lies. Instead, be ready to give an answer to anyone who asks you about your hope in Christ. What do you do when your supervisor is deciding on whom to promote in the company and you know you're in the running, but you recently have learned that he dislikes employees who have conservative social convictions? So it's either a promotion or a personal compromise. What do you do when that freshman philosophy professor spends time in class berating those ignorant Christians who believe that God is in control of the climate, that he only created two genders, that he has a plan in the future for a literal nation, Israel? And then he asks, anybody in here believe that stuff? Raise your hand. Thank you. Well, that would make me that liberal professor, so never mind. What do you do when a neighbor or a coworker or a boyfriend says to you, you know, I think the Bible is just a little too narrow. It kind of bothers me. Isn't God going to allow good people into heaven who are at least sincere about their religious beliefs? Peter's writing to you and me. He's effectively saying, look, if I know you're going to be tempted to think that the best thing you can do to have a good life ahead, an enjoyable life, is to distance yourself, you know, to some degree from Jesus, to go quiet about your convictions, to be silent more than to speak about your salvation. But I want you to know that I speak from experience, Peter is saying. The best life that you could ever have, even if it brings more pressure, is to keep from speaking lies and be ready to give an answer for the hope that's in you. I believe Peter's writing with the memory of that night he caved under pressure when he told a little lie and then another one and then another one. Have you ever thought about the fact that one of the most well-known passages in Peter's biography isn't his sermon on the day of Pentecost? I wonder how many of us can even remember his main points. The most well-known passage in his biography is his denial of Christ in that courtyard of the high priest. And the Lord, by the way, recorded it in all four Gospels so that we couldn't miss it, because we need it. So let's go gather there today. Let's go back to chapter 22 in Luke's Gospel, if you're new to our study. Verse 54. We read, then they seized him, that is Jesus, and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house, and Peter was following at a distance. Now, the high priest's compound, really more like a palace, was bordered by a wall with gates that were locked. Household servants guarded the gate. We know from John's account in chapter 18 that John the Apostle had also come along and gotten inside. In fact, John writes in his account, chapter 18, verses 15 to 16, Simon Peter followed Jesus and so did another disciple. John always refers to himself in that way. Remains anonymous. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, being a relative probably of Zechariah the priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter was still outside the door. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. Now, let me tell you, we're gonna divide what happens next into four scenes just to help us guide us through this exposition. I want to call scene one, small talk at the fireside. Verse 55 in Luke's account now. Now when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them. Now we know John had gone further inside with Jesus and the Sanhedrin. Peter has shuffled over to the fire. It's midnight, the air's chilly. So Peter's gonna just blend in. Well, good luck with that, Peter. I don't believe in luck, by the way. Peter doesn't have any anyways, you'll find out if you don't know already. Verse 56, then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light and looking closely at him, said, this man also was with him. Now, according to John's gospel, this is the same girl that let him in. And ever since, you know, she let Peter in, she's had her suspicions, and she's just not going to let him go. So she comes over to this little fire. In fact, the Greek expression indicates she's staring at him in that flickering firelight until she's certain of it. She puts two and two together. John knows Peter. Peter knows John. John had her let Peter into the courtyard. John is a follower of Jesus. That's obvious. So that means Peter is a follower of Jesus too. I need to understand, at this point, John is openly claiming to know Christ. Peter's life is not in danger. In fact, John's inside the house. The Sanhedrin will not arrest John, even after Jesus is carted away. They really don't care about John. They don't care about Peter. She's not identifying, by the way, Peter here so that Peter can get arrested. She's actually mocking Peter and his association with Jesus. In fact, her words are tinged with sarcasm. We get a clearer view of that from Matthew's account that records her saying this in chapter 26, verse 69. You also were with Jesus, and she adds this little, the Galilean. And notice she doesn't say, you were with Jesus, the healer. You were with Jesus, the great rabbi, the great teacher. Jesus, the miracle worker. No. Jesus, the Galilean. You have to understand that in these days, to refer to somebody as a Galilean wasn't a reference to their hometown. It was a cut down. It was a slur. It was a sarcastic statement that you're backwoods. You're uneducated. In Jesus' day, the citizens of Jerusalem and that region used the Galileans as the butt of their jokes. The northern Galileans were considered in these days less refined, less sophisticated than those southern Israelites. So the southerners ridiculed those backward northerners for their primitive ways. Sort of like today, only reversed, right? The northerners tend to look down on the southerners as being less sophisticated. The northerners talk about those hillbillies down south. They talk funny. Well, don't look so innocent. You're from New York. Got a lot of Yankees in here. You talk funny too, just for the record. You New Englanders, you know, I'm going to go park the car in the yard. I have no idea what you mean when you say that. Or maybe you're from New Jersey. Can't you say your R's? I better not keep going with this idea here. Now, we know from history that Galileans talked with a different accent. In fact, they found it difficult to pronounce some of the gutturals in the dialect that was more refined in this region of Jerusalem, the city. They were viewed as ignorant. So this little servant girl is making fun of Peter. She's saying, "Aren't you following that backward, ignorant man? You're one of them." Verse 57, but he denied it, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." Now, at this point, Matthew's gospel inserts this very interesting result. Chapter 14 and verse 68. But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you mean." And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. The other gospel accounts only record the rooster crowing once, after the third denial. If you compare the gospel accounts, Jesus says in Matthew's account, "I tell you this very night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Luke writes, "I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny three times that you know me." John writes it this way, "I say to you, the rooster will not crow till you have denied me three times." But Mark records Jesus saying, "This very night before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." Now, there are several ways to understand this. First, the rooster crow was a Roman expression for the changing of the guard. In fact, the official Latin term they used for this trumpet call was gallicinium. That translated meant the rooster crow. The rooster crow took place at the end of the third watch at 3 a.m. Now, the Romans divided, the soldiers did, the night watch into four segments. The first watch was 6 to 9 p.m. The second watch was 9 to midnight. The third watch was 12 to 3 a.m. And the fourth watch was 3 a.m. to 6 a.m., called the morning. I don't see anybody writing this down. You're going to need to know this for the test, okay? Well, just remember it this way. Mark spells it out and helps us understand this back in chapter 13. Jesus says this to his disciples. Let me put what Jesus said in bold letters. "Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. In the evening, 6 to 9 p.m., at midnight, 9 to 12, or when the rooster crows," that's 12 to 3 a.m., "or in the morning, 3 to 6 a.m. Now, some would say that Peter's denial then occurred at the trumpet blast, which signaled the end of the 3 a.m. watch. I think that's actually a fascinating possibility, except for the fact that Mark tells us the rooster crowed not just at Peter's third denial, but after his first denial. And I'm pointing this out because that liberal professor that you have, or you had, or you will have in your freshman religion class, who notches his belt with Christians who cave in when they enter his classroom, is going to point out a discrepancy like this, and he's going to turn to this passage. So remember, putting the gospel records together gives you the fullest account. They each heard or saw something that they would later recount. Some focus on one thing, some on another. Mark is the only gospel writer to add this. And I think it's interesting because Mark was discipled by Peter. He received much of his information for his gospel account from Peter. In fact, Peter closes his first letter by referring to Mark as his son. Just like Paul refers to Timothy on four occasions as his son. Early church fathers, Justin Martyr, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, and others would write that Mark was Peter's traveling scribe. We might think of him as an administrative assistant. And he wrote everything down. Mark gives us this detail about that night because Peter never forgot it. It's a significant detail, and I want to come back to it later. Let's go to the second scene. We'll call this one Denial at the Back Gate. Luke 22, now verse 58. And a little later, someone else saw him and said, "You also are one of them." But Peter said, "Man, I am not." Mark's gospel informs us that Peter's moved away from that fire. Got a little too hot there. He's back over by the gate. Attendants are still over there, both young men and women. One of them basically makes the same accusation. Now, at this point, it isn't so much mockery as it is them demanding his honesty. He's being told, "Look, why don't you just fess up? Why don't you admit it? You're one of them. Tell us the truth." Matthew's account adds, at this point, he denied it with an oath. Getting a little more serious. That's like an oath is like swearing, you know, on your grandmother's grave. It's calling down God's judgment upon you if you're not telling the truth. In our court system, it might mean putting your hand on a Bible or swearing to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. You're calling down, that's kind of an oath. And then the witness proceeds to lie. Peter puts his hand on the Bible, so to speak, and says with an oath, "I am not one of those disciples." But he's getting cornered. The pressure is on. Now, I want you to keep this in mind. These denials didn't happen suddenly, one after another. Luke is compressing 9 verses into these 4 scenes, which took several hours to unfold. Now, scene 3. We'll call it the meltdown in the courtyard, Luke 22, verse 59. And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, "Certainly this man also was with him, for he too is a Galilean." You guys sound alike, got the same accent. But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you are talking about." And Matthew's account says that Peter added to the oath that he began to swear. Now, why would Peter do that? Well, at this point, John's gospel account gives us a clue. He writes that this individual making this accusation was now bringing into play something very dangerous to Peter's future, if not his life. John writes it this way: "One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, 'Did I not see you in the garden?'" In other words, hey, you're not only one of Jesus' disciples, you're the guy that cut my cousin's ear off, aren't you? You tried to kill him. All of a sudden, this becomes dangerous. He's now possibly in trouble with the law. He could not only be charged with, you know, following a deluded rabbi who's a heretic, but charged with attempted murder. So Peter reverts to his old life. He pulls out his old vocabulary. He's going to prove he's not following some religious nut. He's not the kind of guy that, you know, would follow a religious teacher around. Are you kidding? And to prove it, Peter starts cursing like the sailor he used to be. Those words are still there. Luke writes here at the end of verse 60, "And immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed." Luke uses an article, the rooster, which indicates it's an animal. He doesn't use the more official term in this verse for that trumpet call for the changing of the guard. In fact, Luke emphasizes, I want you to notice this, that Peter's memory is stirred not by the rooster, but by what happened next. Verse 61, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. Now let's take a closer look at that scene. That's scene four. I'd like to entitle that The Look That Spoke Volumes. Now for several hours, if you follow the Gospels, the Lord has been in this room. He's been surrounded by Supreme Court justices, Roman soldiers, temple police. They're bloodthirsty. They're infuriated. They're insulting Jesus. They're outraged. They're yelling at him. They're punching him. They're pulling some of his beard out. He is now, by now, bloody and bruised. But he's still God the Son. He's still in control. And he's actually been listening to Peter. The text indicates that Jesus purposefully turned and looked at him. Maybe he was through an open window. We don't know. Maybe he's just now being carted in chains through the courtyard. And their eyes meet. It was Jesus' initiative. He looked at Peter. Peter remembered. I often think when I get to this point, reading some time ago the true story of a young mother who rescued her little baby girl and their house caught on fire, and she fought her way through the flames and into the daughter's nursery and grabbed her and ran to safety. And in the process of saving her, her hands and her face were permanently disfigured. The little girl grew up to become a popular teenager, and when her senior class took a day trip on a yacht, her mother volunteered with other mothers to come along and help in the galley prepare the meals. And that afternoon, the girls were all out on the deck and began talking about this woman they'd seen in the galley with scarred hands and face. And one girl asked, I wonder who that ugly woman is. Not knowing her mother was just around the corner and close enough to hear, she heard her own daughter say, I don't know who she is. These words are barely out of Peter's mouth. His face is contorted in anger and frustration and fear, and he's cursing, and his curses are piercing the air as the Lord turns and looks at him. What was in that look? Disappointment? Sadness? Anger? That look that told Peter, you're in trouble? Wait till I rise again? Maybe it was that kind of look. Your mother had that kind of look. My mother, the master of that look. She could look at my three brothers and I, especially in church, just lean forward and look, just that look. We'd freeze. Our blood would freeze. The pastor would freeze. Birds in midair would freeze. We're not told what kind of look this was. But I don't believe it was some withering glare. Just wait. No. Remember, Jesus already knew Peter would fail. He told him he would. Remember? Peter, you're going to deny me And I know how many times. 3. But I've already prayed for you. Remember? He knew. It was a look of hope, hurt, sorrow. Not for himself, but for Peter. Before we leave this scene, let me draw from it some reminders for us today. First, remember to be on guard for that sin you are convinced you would never commit. I mean, just a few hours earlier, if you could interview Peter in the upper room, Peter, what's the one thing you'll never do? Oh, let me tell you, I'll never deny Jesus. That's the one thing I will never, ever do. That leads me to the second lesson. Remember that being courageous in one moment does not guarantee courage in the next moment. You know, just a few hours after the upper room, he's charging 800 armed soldiers with his little sword, swinging it rather wildly. He was courageous. He was at that moment willing to die for Jesus. He wasn't going to get out of there alive. But now, never view yourself as impervious to defeat, as if you've got some kind of spiritual, you know, force field. We have no guaranteed a victory over any sin. This is a reminder we are all capable of committing the worst sins. None of us are beyond anything. That person you see staring back at you in the mirror, never trust them. He's the most dangerous enemy you've got in your life. And the minute you start telling yourself, I'm clear of that stuff, you're in danger. Third, remember that you rarely walk into sin without plenty of warning. Maybe today is a warning. That rooster crowed after Peter's first denial. Let me go back there. Wasn't that gracious of the Lord? Just a reminder. Hey, that's number one, but two more are coming. Unless you change course. But Peter had already set himself up, as we've studied together, to fall down hours earlier. Remember, the Lord had invited him into the garden to pray, and then Peter said, no, what I really need is sleep. And Jesus said to him in verse 40, the same chapter, pray that you may not enter into temptation. What he meant was pray that you not enter into temptation unprepared. Jesus knew temptation was coming. Warning after warning. You ever thought about the fact that we have the same warnings from God about sin in print, in black and white? What's worse, ignoring the warning of the living word or ignoring the warning of the written word? Warning after warning. For us all. Fourth, remember that one sin usually leads to another, so confess quickly before it spreads. Don't let it spread. No one gets up in the morning. None of us ever get up in the morning and say, you know, I think I'm going to start living a lie. You know, I think today, as soon as I can, I'm going to deny Jesus. I'm going to be a coward today. I'm going to do what Peter did. I think I'll say farewell to my integrity. That's my goal for today. No. So watch out for those little steps early on. That lingering look. That click of the mouse. that thought, a little urge to follow through this afternoon. If you're going to watch some football, I plan to if you don't call me. Doesn't it irritate the daylights out of you that every other commercial is, place your bet, place your bet, place your bet. What about you? You know, it's only $5. And you end up like a man I know who had to tell his wife that he had gotten so deeply involved with online gambling that he had just gambled away their home. J.C. Ryle wrote more than 100 years ago, "Beware the beginnings of backsliding, however small." Here's a fifth reminder. Remember, your testimony is not determined by what you say about Jesus to believers in here, but what you say about Jesus to unbelievers out there. The test of your testimony isn't in here. This is easy. We're cheering each other on, and it's great, isn't it? It's out there. The test of Peter's commitment to Jesus wasn't what he said in the upper room. It's what he's going to say in the courtyard. So take a realistic evaluation at what you say at the Christmas office party. Or the conversation in the hallway. Or to an unkind neighbor. Or to that professor. To unbelievers out there, there's the test. One more lesson to remember. Remember, the mercy and grace of Jesus, who already knows when you're going to sin. Peter is now this foul-mouthed, deceitful disciple, but he wasn't kicked to the curb, was he? His failure was, by the grace of God, not final. And that's because of the tears of repentance he sheds. The emphasis is on the bitterness of his soul. He's going to be eager, more eager than ever, to serve the Lord if the Lord will allow it. And when Jesus rose from the dead, I love this text. Only Mark records this. Again, Peter never got over it. Peter evidently was just so amazed by the Lord's mercy. An angel at the tomb instructed the women, you may remember, who had come to anoint the body. And the angel said to them, "Jesus is not here. He's risen." And then they say this, "But go tell the disciples and Peter." I love that. Tell the disciples, oh, don't forget, Peter's one of them. Because Peter doesn't think he will be. Jesus was not finished with Peter. Beloved, the wonderful news is he's not finished with you or me either. He already knows. Think of it. He already died for your future sin. Now, does that mean you just go sin? Oh, I got a free pass now. Well, that's what was Paul preached and taught on the doctrines of grace. That's what people accused him of. Why, you're just going to go sin? Why not? Why not live a lie in order to get ahead? Well, Peter told us why in that opening verse we looked at from his first letter. Now, he's an old apostle. He's learned a lesson. He's passing it on to us. So here it is again in closing. Peter writes, "Whoever desires to love life and to see good days," I mean days that really are good, "clean conscience, fellowship with the Lord, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking lies. Instead, be ready to give an answer to anyone who asks you about your hope in Christ."